Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. On today's program, I'll be talking to writer, poet, and editor Elizabeth Holmes. Holmes is a graduate of Davidson College, and she received her MFA in poetry from Cornell University. She is author of 3 middle grade novels and 3 collections of poetry, including The Patience of the Cloud Photographer, The Playhouse Near Dark, and her most recent is called Passing Worlds, Tahiti in the Era of Captain Cook. And it was published this year by Louisiana State University Press, and it is what we will be discussing today. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, before we dip into this new collection, which, by the way, is really fascinating, I'd like to talk to you about how you came upon poetry. What was the process?
How I came upon poetry in general?
As a writer and as somebody who obviously loves it.
You know, poetry was part of my childhood in a way because I had a grandmother who liked to get me to memorize poems. And she had a store of poems in her memory, which saw her through some insomnia nights. Mm. And she favored things with rousing rhythms and all sorts of Walter Scott and
dramatic.
All sorts of people with 3 names from the 19th century. And, you know, it was great fun. I think I sort of took to it. And it was always the part that attracted me in high school English and college.
Uh-huh. So you've been attracted to it from childhood, it sounds like, yeah.
Yeah.
That's a nice way to begin, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, okay, the new book, Passing Worlds, it's about early expeditions of Europeans to the small island of Tahiti. What attracted you to this subject? This is such an obscure kind of subject to be writing about.
Well, I thought so, too, and I fell into it sort of accidentally at a point when I was just thinking, you know, my whole education has been mostly in humanities. I know so little about science. I should read something. And I was reading a book by Richard Holmes, who's no relation to me, called The Age of Wonder, and the subtitle is something like How the Romantic Generation Discovered the Beauty and Terror of Science.
Ah.
And he zeroed in on Joseph Banks, who was with Captain Cook on his expedition to Tahiti and beyond. And I was really struck by his portrait of Banks. It was a very sympathetic portrait. Not all writers are that sympathetic to Banks. But Banks went into this largely unknown society. There had been a report from one previous ship. And he became just engrossed in the culture. He was an aristocratic, wealthy Englishman with a great sense of his superiority, certainly, to most other people in the world, certainly including the uncivilized people, as he would have said.
Mm-hmm.
But he really turned himself into an ethnographer, which was a profession or an interest that hardly existed at that time. This is late 1700s, around 1770. And he really immersed himself in the culture. Mm-hmm. And he wrote a copious journal entries about every possible custom of the people.
So this got you interested in this whole subject, I take it, yeah?
It did, and I was intrigued by the crossing of the cultural boundary, by the fact that this man who, you know, in a pretty imperial age, even, I mean, it's the Enlightenment, but there's lots of imperialism, and that he respected the culture he encountered enough to really study it and understand where these people were coming from.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
intrigued me, and I thought I would write more about Joseph Banks, but as I got further into it, the subject just expanded tremendously.
Oh, I can see that. Yeah, fascinating segues. And tell us how you did research on this. I mean, initially you found that book, but what else did you do? You talk about the whole culture and the whole time.
Well, really, I was not very systematic. I didn't know if this was going to be a big project, but one thing led to another. I think I went next to a biography of Joseph Banks, and then I began to dip into his journals and Captain Cook's journals. And I read, there's a very lively account of an earlier English ship that was there briefly, and that was great fun to read.
Hmm.
And I got into, and then I discovered a wonderful scholar named Anne Salmond, who's a New Zealander, who had written some great books of detailed history of these encounters and who really understood the native perspective.
Wow, that's
And that
that's
was really
new, yeah.
eye-opening for
yeah,
me.
Yeah. Well, I want to have you read a poem from Passing Worlds. This one's called Iron. Tell us just a bit about it, and then please read it for us.
Okay. Iron is a short poem that zeroes in on that one material, iron, just to try to set the stage for the gap between the two cultures that were encountering each other here. Iron. In earth an ore, a rust-red vein, a streak in hematite or black-band ironstone, a taste in the water. Mined, smelted, fired, and forced into cast bars for the blacksmith's anvil, hammered to hard shape, hard use. On a ship, by the hundreds, bolts, rings, spikes, hinges, plates, nails, hooks. In the hold, for trade with the natives, hatchets and knives. In the hands of marines, musket and bayonet, balls, small shot. On Tahiti, none. Until.
Wow. You know, I was wondering when I read that poem the first time, I was wondering, do you approach poetry differently, knowing that you're writing about something that's in real history?
Well, I think I always wanted to stick to the facts. I didn't want to make up a narrative, but I wanted to look at it from different angles. I mean, it's very different from if I was trying to write a prose account of what happened at
right.
these encounters. I wanted to use different voices, take different perspectives, look at facets of it.
Mm-hmm. But you still have to use your imagination and, you know, poetic license, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
when you're writing in this kind of venue.
Uh-huh.
So I was just wondering how much license you gave yourself to, because it's beautiful poetry too, and I would think it would be a little bit harder to do that, knowing that you're trying to be true to a story.
It can be at times. I remember one just fascinating little fact that I had to take out when I discovered that it actually was not a fact.
Oh.
So that was disappointing. But I think you try to imagine yourself into the place of the people who were there, which is much harder to do with the native people because they didn't leave a written record.
Oh, right.
So I have to say I did the best I could with that.
Yeah. Well, it's a beautiful collection. Let's have you read another from Passing Worlds. This one's called Joseph Banks, Botanist and Patron.
Yes, this is one of several poems that are set in the section during which Captain Cook's ship, the Endeavour, is traveling to Tahiti, which is a very long journey in those days. And it focuses on Joseph Banks, who I was just talking about. And there are several quotations here that are italic, so you won't hear them, but it's particularly in the first stanza. These are excerpts from letters written by Joseph Banks's tutor at Eton when he was very young, written to his father reporting back on how he was doing, and he was not a very good scholar. 14 and lordly, a great inattention in him, rich boy at Eton, and an immoderate love of play. But one warm evening alone in the gold light of a lane richly enameled with flowers, for the first time he saw what flowers are. Under the shimmer of color whose beauty drew him, near infinite variety. A leaf like moist silk, another leather, sawtoothed, ribbed, blossoms, trumpet, hood, soft spokes, diverse delicate turns of a petal's fluting, dance of stamen, pistil, pollen, bee. He would learn botany, learn the whole natural world. Rich boy, but only one book, his mother's tattered Gerard's Herbal, and no teacher, Eaton imparting not the thinnest slice of science. And so, what else became visible? Women. Poor country women, gypsies, gatherers of simples, who searched out, dug, picked, and sold to apothecaries their stock in trade. Their wrinkles and rough hands, rural accent, rude grammar. No word of Latin, letter of Greek. No ladies' learning of harpsichord, embroidery, gavotte, minuet. They made their living by leaf and flower, berry and root, by knowing how each in poultice or tea might heal. Rich boy, yes, but a mind that could listen, knew when the foreign, the inferior, could teach him, paid sixpence for each bit of knowledge, and learned.
Yeah, I love that. So Joseph Banks obviously was somewhat of an exception as an English person in a foreign land, right? Why do you think he was so sensitive to this experience? Is it because he was interested in nature?
I think that was partly it. He went on the voyage initially as a naturalist, especially a botanist. His interest in the people developed as he was there. But this is, of course, in the days when people didn't specialize in the sciences.
Right, right.
When to be a naturalist and have a grasp of the whole natural world was considered attainable and was sort of something that a few select gentlemen did.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a man with just enormous curiosity.
That is helpful, too. Mm-hmm. Did you ever visit Tahiti? Did you experience any of this yourself, at least the modern part of it?
I didn't. Over the several years it took me to write this book, I thought sometimes that that might be a handicap and that I really should go to Tahiti. I was hesitant partly because of the vast distance and expense of getting there, mm-hmm. and also because it has changed so much. I know there are places that were central to these encounters that just couldn't be, that Captain Cook would certainly not recognize today. So in the end, I did not go. I'd still like to go there someday.
Yeah. Well, it feels like you captured the experience of visiting a small island. I'm not sure how you were able to translate that. I was sure you must have visited.
You know, I drew on what I read, the pictures I saw, and my limited experience in tropical or semi-tropical places, and hoped for the best.
But a lot of this was from your imagination, right?
Yes, trying to take the facts I knew and develop something from there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think it's really interesting that unknown people that you pull out of the hat, and it was an incredible discovery, it seems to me.
Of this island and the people there. It was an incredible discovery. It provoked a lot of discussion in Europe. When these people returned from their voyage, there was great curiosity, and in a lot of parts of Europe, an idea caught on that this was some kind of utopia, that it was really Paradise Island, that nobody was poor, and it was easy to make a living, unlike in chilly, damp England, wonderful fruit grew on all the trees. And this was a very idealistic portrait. There was a certain amount of truth to it, and there were a lot more negatives to this society that people didn't realize.
If you're just joining us, my guest is poet Elizabeth Holmes. We're talking about her new book, Passing Worlds, Tahiti in the Era of Captain Cook. Let's talk about Captain Cook now. He's the instigator of this collection, at least. To tell us a little bit about him.
Captain Cook was a very principled man, a person who was eager for travel and adventure and discovery. He was ambitious. He had come from very humble origins. I believe his father was some type of laborer, not a seaman, some sort of farm laborer maybe.
Hmm.
And so he was able to rise in the Navy by sheer ability and not by patronage, as many officers were. And he was on this particular voyage, I think he was much of the time at his best. He was judicious. He was quite open-minded about the people there. He was a strict disciplinarian in the way of ships in those days, but not an abusive one. He made two other voyages to the South Pacific after this, in which things didn't always go so well. Mm. And on his third voyage, he was killed by natives at Hawaii.
Wow. Wow, what an adventure.
But he was a very talented man.
Really adventurous life. Wow. And let's have you read another from Passing Worlds. This one's called Parkinson Die Making.
Yeah, Sidney Parkinson is one of my favorite characters in this, and I wrote several poems from his point of view. He was 25 years old or so. He was a Quaker, unlike almost anyone else on this ship. He was quite serious and religious, and he was brought because he was an extremely talented botanical draftsman, an artist, who in those days without cameras, you had to have artists.
Yeah.
And Cook's voyage also had someone else who was primarily a landscape painter, although he unfortunately died of an illness early on. But Sidney Parkinson wrote a fascinating journal about his part in this journey, and he is a very sensitive observer. So this is one of his experiences there, which brings up one of the great issues of this voyage, which is sex. It's called Parkinson Die Making, and it has an epigraph from Sidney Parkinson's journal. The color is good, but whether it will stand, I am unable to determine. In a breadfruit grove a little inland from the trafficked shore, in shade of broad leaves she bent easy as a willow, and the loose drape of bark cloth did not conceal her perfect form. She picked a leaf, and from a fig pressed out upon it a milky fluid, rubbing gently. I leaned close to see, warm scent of coconut, slight scar at her clavicle, tender pink edges, the mingled juices of leaf and fig in an instant turned crimson. My hand, of its own will, touched her arm. Fingers traced it to her deft hand. The leaf fell. I led her to a tent and there touched everything alive in both of us. And all the colors ever dreamed bloomed. She left the carmine traces of her fingers on my chest, my arms, truly marks of sin, although I never knew so sweet a sin, nor one with rightness so suffused.
That's great. That was wonderful. Well, what did you come away from personally, you know, researching and writing this collection? It's very elaborate and very detailed.
What did I come away with? I think for me, it was just fascinating to the whole process of making a collection like this, which was something I'd never done before. I had many doubts along the way. I gave up at times, or I thought, well, I'll get a few little poems out of this and onto something else.
Wow.
Thanks to some encouraging friends, I kept going little by little until I could really see a shape to it.
Uh-huh.
And
was it because you got to know the country better and the voyage? And did you have to to look at it from that angle as well?
I think so. Or I began to see how it could have a basic narrative structure that would hold it together rather than being sort of random glimpses of this and that that happened to interest me.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I began to fill in the gaps so that it would be hopefully make a story that a reader can follow all the way through the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, it does. It's intricate, even though it's not a big book, of course, mm-hmm. and not a real history. But it's very detailed, and it would be very interesting, I think, to anybody who's interested, especially in Tahiti. Now, I like your title, Passing Worlds. Did that come from historical time? What is that from?
I'm honestly not sure where I got that title, but what I hope it evokes is the passing of a world, of that Tahitian society that was ultimately just destroyed by this, which is the great irony of this to me, is that people like Captain Cook and a couple of the other sea captains who early on made brief visits to Tahiti were basically well-intentioned people. They were not out to conquer the island. They had no evil designs on the people. And yet the impact of their technology, the diseases they brought, the ways they disrupted with their great power, the way they disrupted the social and political structures of the island was ultimately devastating. Mm. And by some estimates, 90% of the population had disappeared within a couple of generations.
God, isn't that unbelievable? And it is because of the invaders,
mm-hmm.
you know, the disease.
Right.
And
it's
really quite intriguing and devastating to think what we have done.
Mm-hmm. And not, of course, just because of these initial contacts, but because of what they led to. Mm-hmm. The whaling ships who found this a convenient port and were a rough sort and brought all kinds of trouble.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I want to have you read a final poem from Passing Worlds. This one's called In Matavai Bay. I'm not sure how to say it.
My best guess is Matavai.
Okay.
So we'll try that. In Matavai Bay, each anchor's slow fall to the sea floor, a depth charge that roiled the bay, rocked the land. After the first, ships came at odd intervals, then more and more often, emissaries of empire, commerce, God. Whaling ships coasted in, folding their great wings to settle for a bit, eat well for a change, screw women, stock up, move on. Bountiful, stern, the white-sailed sugar daddies gave for sex and hogs and breadfruit, old shirts, dysentery, hatchets, beads, nails, smallpox, rum. Missionaries met ridicule, met rage. Some fled. Others in stone certainty persisted, held sway, calling the Timuridi dance shameful, the gods false and impotent, solemn sacrifice barbarity, rum wrong. Depth of ritual, all color, exuberance, given up for hymns and dour prohibitions. It took time to forget how to make a stone adz, beat bark into cloth. Time to learn to love rum, to learn the first strangers gone, they'd been given syphilis. Time, one or two brief generations, for a people to be decimated. Time to know they were just flotsam, their island wrecked on its own reef, splintered by percussive ripples from each anchor's slow fall.
Wow, that's a great way to end the book, too. Did you feel like you were kind of an explorer, discovering this land, too, and what happened to it? And obviously you got to look at it in retrospect, but to tell us how you felt about that last poem makes me think that you feel a sadness about it all.
Oh, I do, definitely. And I did feel like an explorer, just in the way that anybody does, I think, when exploring a subject that's new to them. I came to this without a lot of knowledge about that period in history or that part of the world. So lots of things were new to me, which made it more fun to investigate.
So why did you think you might quit in the middle, like you said a few minutes ago? What was the frustration around it?
I think because I couldn't see it as a whole, and because I wanted each poem to be absolutely wonderful on its own. And I think in a project like this, you have to accept that not every poem, unless you're the sort of genius that I am not, not every poem is going to knock your socks off. But pieces have to be there, and they connect to each other. And many of the poems, I think, read much better in the context of the book than they do if you just isolated them and handed them to someone.
So did you feel compelled to have the story move along like a novelist? Is that how you want people to read the book, instead of, like what you said, reading them piecemeal and losing kind of the whole picture?
Well, I think it definitely needs to be read in order because it is basically chronological, that it begins with a prophecy made by a native islander that eerily did prefigure some of what happened.
Mm.
And it proceeds through those initial impressions that each side had of the other into their deepening connections, and at the end into a glimpse of the impact that it ultimately had on their society.
Mm-hmm. Well, we are almost out of time, Elizabeth. Tell us, are you going to do another collection like this? Did this get you thinking about themed poetry collections?
It did, and I would love to do another collection like this. I don't think I've found the right subject yet.
Mm.
I've been reading around. I've written a few poems on one particular subject that might have some potential, but I don't know yet.
Yeah, this is very detailed, and it looks like it took you quite a while to write this. It's a really beautiful collection. Can you give us contact information in case people want to get in touch?
Yes. There's a contact link on my website, which is Elizabeth Holmes Poet, all run together, one word, ElizabethHolmesPoet.com.
And they can get in touch with you that way. And I assume the book's on sale in many places.
It is locally here in Ithaca and through the giants of online commerce.
That's great.
And I should mention IndieBound, which is a website that supports independent bookstores.
Wow, that's good to let people know about. Well, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure to read the book and to have you on to talk about it. I hope people will go out and read it.
Thank you, Tish. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.